Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club, and I will be your chair for this evening's program, God's Hotel, a hospital and pilgrimage to the heart of medicine with Dr. Victoria Sweet. This special program is sponsored by Health and Medicine, the member-led forum that is chaired by William Grant. 20 years ago, expecting to stay a short time, Dr. Sweet came to San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital. Many people may not know about Laguna Honda, but many people do know. It was a long-term care hospital for San Francisco people of all backgrounds, ages, economic levels, and physical disabilities. The story of God's Hotel is a story of how 20th century care and medicine at Laguna Honda has led to the visionary emergence of a 21st century model of holistic medical knowledge, new technology and standard, and the skills of doctors, nurses, and caregivers. Dr. Sweet's book, God's Hotel, published by Riverhead Books, has received outstanding book reviews, including the review by Jerome Goodman in the September issue of the New York Book Reviews. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Victoria Sweet and Laguna Honda.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Thanks to Bill Grant for having read God's Hotel and invited me to the Commonwealth Club. I also have a problem sometimes with mics, so if I stop dropping my voice or get too far away, would everybody let me know? Raise your hand. So far, so good? Okay. It was especially wonderful for me to be invited to the Commonwealth Club because I'm a Californian by birth, and my family has been in San Francisco since before the Gold Rush. So it was a really big deal to get invited here. I know for my family, too, that San Francisco always aspired to be a kind of Boston of the West, and it's been pretty successful. In fact, there's a kind of San Francisco Bostonian accent, and whenever I have a patient who's a native San Franciscan, I can usually recognize them. Sort of a upper-class sort of nasal drawl like that, just a tad. The Commonwealth Club, establishing the Commonwealth Club was another way to do that, to be a source of civic pride and civic-ness and culture on this side of the Continental Divide. My great-grandfather belonged to the Commonwealth Club, and so did Charles Wohlenberg, who was head of Laguna Honda for 40 years. In fact, I have a picture of him with Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt in 1911 came and gave a speech at the Commonwealth Club, and after that, Charles Wohlenberg took him on a tour of what was then the new Laguna Honda. In researching this talk, I also discovered the motto of the Commonwealth Club, to find the truth and to let it loose upon the world. What I hope to do this evening is to tell you about some of the truths I found at Laguna Honda and let them loose upon the world. Let me start by saying that I got to Laguna Honda accidentally. I've been practicing medicine for several years, and I was more and more impressed by the power of modern medicine. Not just its technologies, but the power of its logical method of thinking to bring us to a correct diagnosis and a correct treatment. But I was always more and more impressed by what modern medicine leaves out, everything not logical. And I began to wonder whether we once had that illogical part and that it had gotten dropped or discarded. And I decided to go back to school and get a PhD in medical history. And that's how I got to Laguna Honda, because I didn't want to stop practicing medicine, and it was the only place that would let me practice medicine part-time. And I have to say, when I saw Laguna Honda for the first time, I was a bit startled. It looked, at the time, like a 12th century Romanesque monastery. It had peach-colored walls and a red-tiled roof and turrets and a bell tower. I went for my interview, and the medical director then took me out on the tour. She showed me the long open wards that went all the way back to when monks took care of the sick poor for free. We went upstairs, and she showed me the surgical suite, which looked a lot like where Humphrey Bogart gets his face redone in Dark Passage. We went downstairs and she showed me the x-ray department where I would be able to actually take my own x-rays the way I wanted because the x-ray department was right there. And the laboratory that had a very simple microscope and centrifuge, but it meant I could look at samples myself of blood and urine knowing the context of the patient. Then we walked past the 1950s beauty salon, which had steel helmet hair dryers. And she showed me the auditorium, the little store that sold goods to the patients, and the chapel, which was more like a church. It had polished wooden pews and stained glass windows and very politically incorrect stations of the cross along the walls. I can see that some people know that place by your smiles. Yes. And then she took me out to the gardens, because Laguna Honda was and is on 62 acres of land in the middle of the city, and it had extensive gardens. She showed me the greenhouse, the aviary, and the little farm, so that patients could pot plants, watch chickens hatch from eggs, and even see animals, even if they were bedbound. Then we walked back to her office, and she offered me the job. I didn't know. I wasn't sure. On the other hand, it was the only place that was letting me practice medicine part-time, so I told her I would come for 2 months, temporarily. And I ended up staying for more than 20 years. It turned out to be a wonderful place to practice medicine. First of all, the place itself was spacious and open. The windows open, the doors open, the turrets open, the bell tower open. Everything was open, and there was a lovely flow of serendipitous meetings that encouraged. But I especially stayed for the patients. The patients were fascinating, because it turned out that Laguna Honda Hospital was originally the San Francisco Almshouse, which was how we used to take care of patients before there was health insurance. The system, and we still have it in San Francisco, is that there was a free county hospital for the acutely ill and a free county almshouse for everyone else. Anyone who fell through the nets and the holes in the system had some place to go. So originally there were orphans, pregnant unmarried women, lunatics, homeless people, the chronically ill, people who needed rehab, people who just got out of prison, anybody who didn't know what to do, had a place to go, they went to Laguna Honda. And it used to be that every county in the country, just about, had this kind of setup, a free county hospital and a free county almshouse. And they weren't fancy, but they were adequate, and they were free, and everyone knew they had some place to go if they got sick. And starting in the 1950s, they fell out of favor. And gradually, the almshouses and then the county hospitals, many of them were shut down, most, if not all, of the almshouses, as far as I can tell, until San Francisco is, as far as I know, the only place left that has this system intact. And because of that, it was the kind of place, Laguna Honda was the kind of place where we got the bottom 0.1% of everyone. Everyone who fell through the holes in the safety net. And they were fascinating patients because they had almost every disease in the book, and they were 2 standard deviations from the mean. Any mean. They were the tallest and the shortest. Honestly, the fattest and the thinnest, the nicest and the meanest of any patients I ever had. And they had just about every disease, too. So it was a fascinating place, and it taught me a huge amount about medicine and healthcare. efficiency and inefficiency, caring and curing and healing. And if I had to sum up what it taught me in one sentence, what I would say is that it's that medicine is personal. And when it's personal, it works. The best way I can explain what I mean is to tell you a story. Y'all can hear me okay? So far, so good? The story of Dr. Curtis and the case of the missing shoes. I learned a lot from Dr. Curtis, but it was with the case of the missing shoes that he taught me the most about care and caring, time and inefficiency. On this particular day, I met him by accident in the wide-windowed corridor that ran the length of the hospital and connected all the wards. He was in a hurry. "Where was he going?" I asked. "Back to the rehabilitation ward," he said, "where he was covering for a few weeks." Now, the rehabilitation ward, like the admitting ward, was its own mini-hospital within Laguna Honda. It admitted the patients with the milder strokes and the less traumatic head injuries, most of whom would recover and be discharged back to their homes if they had them, although its patients, too, were often without friends, money, or health insurance. Like the admitting ward, it had its own physicians to admit, examine, and discharge its patients, and this month, Dr. Curtis was one of them. He just returned from outside the hospital, he told me, and was headed back to a patient who, having been rehabilitated after a stroke, had been ready for discharge for months. But every day when Dr. Curtis made his rounds, checking on the 36 patients on the ward, this patient was still there, still zipping around in his wheelchair, still going to therapy. Finally, Dr. Curtis said, I asked him why. Since he was able to walk, he was still there. Why was he still in a wheelchair? Why hadn't he been discharged? "No shoes, Doc. They ordered me special shoes, but they're waiting for Medicaid to approve them." "How long have they been waiting?" Dr. Curtis asked. 3 months. Dr. Curtis thought a bit. "What size shoe do you wear?"
"Size 9.
Dr. Curtis reflected for a while. He thought about his duties, his other patients, the charts he had to dictate, the quality assurance forms he had to fill out. And then he left the hospital, got in his car, and drove to Walmart, where he bought a pair of size 9 running shoes for $16.99. He'd just come back with the shoes and was going over to the ward to put them on the patient and write the discharge orders. "Was he planning to submit his receipt for reimbursement?" I asked. He laughed. As I watched him hurry back to the rehabilitation ward, I wondered, why had Dr. Curtis done this? And why hadn't anyone else? It was a simple thing to do, but it never would have occurred to me to do it. I would have been frustrated with the shoe delay, of course, and I would have filled out a second or even a third Medicaid request. I might even have written Medicaid or braved its phone tree to complain about the time that pair of shoes was taking. But it never would have occurred to me to go to Walmart and buy the patient's shoes. I had too much to do, too many forms to fill out, too many other patients to see. It would have meant crossing a kind of inefficiency boundary. And yet Dr. Curtis got in his car without much questioning, and he was hurrying back to the ward with the shoes to put them on the patient himself. He reminded me of an aphorism I loved but had never understood. The secret in the care of the patient is in caring for the patient. I'd always assumed that that meant caring about the patient, loving or at least liking the patient. But when I saw Dr. Curtis rushing off to put shoes on a patient he barely knew, I thought there must be more to it than that. So I tracked down the quote, and I found it in a talk by Dr. Francis Peabody to the graduating medical class of Harvard in 1927. Turned out that Dr. Peabody didn't mean caring about a patient, but caring for a patient, which he explained meant doing the little things, the little daily things that nurses usually do, adjusting a patient's bedclothes or giving him sips of water. That took time, Dr. Peabody admitted, and wasn't perhaps the most efficient way for doctors to spend their time. But it was worth it, he told his students,
because that kind of time-costly caring was what created the personal relationship between patient and doctor. And that relationship was the secret of healing. So what Dr. Peabody really was saying was that the secret in the care of the patient was inefficiency. It was ironic. And it was also ironic that while Deloitte and Touche were examining just about everything about the hospital except its patients, the books, the protocols, the costs, and the revenues, Dr. Curtis had been providing the most efficient healthcare of all, leaving his ostensible duties to perform his real duty. He must have saved the healthcare system many thousands of dollars by buying those shoes, and yet Deloitte and Touche would not have thought his action efficient. They would have thought it very inefficient, wasteful of the time of a highly paid, highly trained physician. What I learned from Dr. Curtis was that medicine is personal. Also, sometimes that what seems to be inefficient is often efficient. In the meantime, I'd started my PhD. I wanted to understand pre-modern medicine. That is, how we practice medicine in the days before the modern period, before stethoscopes and germ theory and cell theory. So I learned Latin and German, paleography, medieval history, medical history, and I then started to focus on Hildegard of Bingen's medicine. Hildegard was a 12th century nun who was also a mystic, a visionary, a composer, and as it turned out, a medical practitioner. And she'd written a book about her medicine. It was fascinating because her book was not the kind of medieval medicine I'd expected. It was not the tongue of frog and kind of medicine I'd expected from a medieval medical text. It was a real patient for real diseases that I could recognize. But it was based on a completely different idea of medicine from our mechanical model. Hildegard's idea was that the patient was more like a plant than a machine, and that the doctor should be more like a gardener than a mechanic. What's the difference? The difference is that somebody has to fix a broken machine, but a plant can heal itself. Hildegard called the power of a plant to heal itself its viriditas, from the Latin viridis, meaning green, which is also where we get the French vert and the Spanish verde. And Hildegard thought that human beings also had their own viriditas, their own natural healing power. So the idea was that the doctor would fuss and fiddle with the patient much more like a gardener fiddles with a plant that's not doing well, rather than like a mechanic who removes broken parts of a machine. It took me quite a long time to figure out what she meant. And it really was with my patient, Terry Becker, that I began to understand what she was getting at. Terry was a street person. She was homeless and she lived on the streets with her boyfriend, Mike. And they smoked and they drank and they took drugs. And things went along quite like that for quite some time, until one day Terry woke up and she was paralyzed from the neck down. Mike took her over to the general. They admitted her and they did all our tests and found out that Terry had a transverse viral myelitis. This is a viral disease. We don't know what causes it. There's no treatment. But typically it gets gradually better after the nerves of the spinal cord are destroyed. They do seem to regrow and people can be expected to get much better. So they sent her over to Laguna Honda for rehabilitation. And she did pretty well for the first few weeks. She started getting her arm movement back and some of her shoulders movement. But then the first of the month rolled around. Now, the first of the month in San Francisco is when the homeless people get their welfare cash. And Mike showed up, her boyfriend, and took Terry out. He said he would come back. And I watched them leave in the wheelchair. I didn't hear from Terry again for another year. Later, I found out that she'd been to the emergency room 28 times, that she'd been admitted 3 times for a month-long hospitalization, and that Mike had actually beat her up and robbed her once. Eventually, living on the streets, because every time she got a little bit better, Mike would show up, take her back, living on the back to the street, she had developed a huge bed sore. It started out fairly small. She was admitted to the general. It was grafted. Mike would show up. She'd go back to the streets. The graft would fail. This happened 3 times. Finally, that bed sore was impossible to graft. It was so huge. The surgeons didn't know what to do, so they sent her over to Laguna Honda, and I was her doc, and I admitted her. And this is what it looked like. Terry's bed sore was the worst I'd ever seen. It was huge, enormous, and deep. It went from the middle of her back all the way down to her tailbone, and it spanned both of her sit bones. The skin was completely gone, of course, but so were the fat and the muscles that covered the spine. In their place was an unidentifiable mass of decayed and decaying and infected tissue from the failed skin graft. And at the bottom of this wide, deep hole, I could see bone, Terry's spine. Terry's bed sore was scary. She had no protection. Everything delicate and crucial in her body, bones, kidneys, spinal cord, was exposed and vulnerable to an environment full of danger, full of germs. Giving antibiotics to try to prevent infection wouldn't protect her, and the bed sore was too big to graft, even if the surgeons agreed. It would have to heal on its own, and that would take years. In the meantime, what chance did Terry have of not getting an overwhelming infection that would kill her? I walked back to our little doctor's office, and I sat down at my rickety desk. I stared for quite a while at the wooden shelf on which was Mrs. McCoy's robust plant, now grown all over the wall. This bed sore was a catastrophe, and possibly the end of Miss Terry Becker. I thought about Hildegard, and I asked myself, what would Hildegard do? How would she treat Terry Becker's huge and open wound? And as I did so, I stared into Mrs. McCoy's green plant. What she would do, I suddenly saw, was remove obstructions to Terry's viriditas, to Terry's natural ability to heal. Because if nothing was in its way, then viriditas would heal her wound as surely as a plant will grow green. What was in its way, I asked myself. The mass of dead tissue was in its way, and every bit of it had to be removed. Any pressure on Terry's body, from wrinkled bedclothes to hard mattresses, was also in its way and had to be removed. Anything that interfered with the circulation of her blood, nicotine, for instance, was in the way of viriditas. Dirt, unkemptness, stale clothes, unnecessary medications, all were in its way. My first job, therefore, as gardener doctor, was not to make a brilliant diagnosis or give any special medication, but to remove obstructions to Terry's own viriditas. What else? In addition, what my strategy would be, I understood from Hildegard, was that, in addition to removing obstructions to viriditas, I would fortify Terry's viriditas with good nutrition, tasty food, vitamins, liquids, deep sleep, fresh air, and sunlight. After that, peace, rest, safety. Not much else. It might be just that simple. Oh, and time. As much time as Terry needed. It was quite amazing how fast Hildegard's prescription worked. Within a few weeks, I began to see signs of healing deep within Terry's wound. There was no infection. And deep down, at the base of the wound, was it my imagination? There was a smooth and pink glistening, which was starting to cover and protect her spine. But then the first of the month rolled around, and Mike showed up. He was still pretty cute, still wearing his tight Levi's, still walking with a flirtatious, though constrained, strut. The nurses made him wait in the smoking room, and Terry wheeled herself on her gurney, face down, back covered, the whole length of the ward. Then she rolled into the smoking room. They were there a long time. Then the door opened, and Mike came out and left. Terry had thrown him out. She told him never to come back. Then she stopped smoking. So her appetite improved and she gained weight. Without nicotine constricting her blood vessels, the tiny new arteries and veins at the base of her bedsore could absorb the vitamins and protein she was eating, and the hole in her backside began to fill in. Since I did not check the bedsore daily, but only once a week, its progress seemed as magical to me as one of those time-lapse movies they showed us in school, where a plant grows from a seed in a matter of minutes. Terry's wound began to look like a huge scab. The scab thickened until it was even with the rest of the skin, and then, just as petals push against the constriction of the bud and open it, so the scab flaked off and there was pink skin underneath. That awful crater filled in from bottom to top and from side to side. It took a long time. It took 2.5 years. But we were in no hurry, and neither was she. One day, toward the end of the 2.5 years, the social worker found her brother, who still lived back in Arkansas with his wife and 2 children. He asked whether his sister could come and live with him. He was not rich. He didn't have the money to send for her, but if the hospital would send her out to Arkansas, he would do the rest. And that's what we did. Terry changed the way I practice medicine. After her, I not only looked at patients with the eye of a modern doctor, focusing in on what was wrong and how I could fix it, but I also stepped back and looked at my patients in the context of their environment and asked myself, what can I do to fortify viriditas? What can I do to remove what's in its way? I began to think of it as sort of a slow medicine. And I found that it worked really well on patients who had what I thought of as slow diseases, diseases that were slow in coming on, that took a long time to develop, or diseases for which there was no known medical treatment, as opposed to fast medicine, which I also use, and which works so well when a patient is in a car accident or has a heart attack or needs an appendectomy, but doesn't work so well after the car accident, the heart attack, or the appendectomy. I began to think of slow medicine, fast medicine as tools in my doctor bag, and that the point was to use the right tool for the right patient at the right time. In the meantime, Gunahanda had been discovered. Healthcare economists, lawyers, the Department of Justice, the Healthcare Financing Administration had made its way over the hill to the poorhouse, and they did not like what they saw. They didn't like the big open ramshackle place. They didn't like the open windows and the open doors and the open turrets and the open bell tower. They didn't like how things flowed in that place. And they insisted that San Francisco either close the old place down or build a new, modern rehabilitation facility. It was pretty amazing because nobody expected that bond to pass. And some of you here probably know about all the politics and fights and struggles that went on. But San Francisco did pass that bond 2-1. We had the money to rebuild. And for about 10 years, architects and then contractors and workers were appearing on the campus. And things were flowing along. I did my best to ignore that situation and just carry on with what I was doing, but one day I was driving in, and I saw the hospital, the new hospital, kind of arising from the valley, and I realized suddenly it was going to happen. And then once that did happen, once we moved into the new place, that nobody would understand the lessons I'd learned. And that was when I decided to write this book, God's Hotel, so that I could hopefully pass on some of the lessons I'd learned at the old Laguna Honda. We moved into the new place about 2 years ago, and I took what's turning into a very long sabbatical so that I could write the book, and now I'm going around the country meeting people. Over the last 25 years, what I've been struck by is how the pendulum of healthcare has swung from the personal to the efficient. And I've been ever more and more impressed by how inefficient that efficiency is. Despite all the changes, healthcare costs keep going up. Patients, doctors, and even healthcare economists are ever more frustrated, and no one seems to know what to do. To give you an example of what I mean, I'll show you something that I know very well, and that is what happened at Laguna Honda. I actually made a series of graphs. Let me go back here. Actually, I need to go over here and see what I'm doing. So, actually, I'm going to go over here and use this like cool little thing here. Yeah. Okay. Cool. So this is I put this together.
Victoria.
Oh, I can't.
We're
good. I'm not allowed to do that. Sorry about that. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Here we are. It's too far away from me, and it's probably too far away from a lot of you in the back. But this is a graph I made of the 20 years I was at Laguna Honda or so, of the patients and the doctors. Over the course of the 20 years, as a cost-cutting measure, the number of patients at Laguna Honda was decreased by about 40%, from 1,178 to 780, gradually. The number of doctors was decreased by 80%. From 32 to 9. The clinical staff was decreased as well, from about 1,200 to... Actually, I have to get my notes here. Sorry. Was cut by... The clinical staff of nurses, therapists, and social workers was cut by 30%. And yet, the budget has kept rising. What accounts for that? The number of management staff. As you can see, even though the clinical staff has decreased, the total staff has stayed the same. Management increased every year. In fact, by the time I left, there were more quality assurance managers at Laguna Honda than there were doctors. And that was pretty scary. What does all this new management and administration do? It's hard to know for sure, but the one thing that there are more of at Laguna Honda today than when I started is forms. When I first got to Laguna Honda, there were two single-page forms in the chart. I'll explain this in a second. The day I left, I pulled a patient's chart out randomly, and I counted. There were 43 forms, and they weren't single-page forms either. They were three-page forms, five-page forms, 10-page forms. The charts were exploding from the forms. And this is the graph I made at the time. As you can see, so this is what I was showing you before. So we've got the patients. Doesn't seem to like to go on here. The patients going down here. We've got the doctors going down. We've got the clinical staff staying about the same. The total staff staying about the same, and the budget going up, and these are the forms. And I actually prognosticated, as a good, you know, statistician should, that if current trends continue, by 2024, the number of patients at Laguna Honda will hit zero. There'll be two physicians, 1,400 full-time staff, and a budget of $280 million. And I don't know how many forms. So what to do? Coming back to the Commonwealth Club and its motto, what truths did I find at Laguna Honda, and how can we turn them loose on the world? I found many truths, but two in particular that have policy significance. The first truth is how useful it is to have the old system of a free county hospital and a free county almshouse. We're lucky to have that in San Francisco. It isn't perfect, of course. It's expensive and it's jammed up, but at least we do have some place to send patients, and patients always have some place to go. I wish all the counties in the country had that system. And in flights of fancy, I wonder whether we could resuscitate it throughout the country. They'd be funky, maybe, but they'd be adequate and they'd be free. Because the thing is, even if all of Obamacare goes into effect, all of its thousands and thousands of new directives, ideas, and regulations, we are still going to have 21 million uninsured people, according to the Congressional Budget Office. And I think sometimes how useful, how comforting it would be for everyone to know that even if they lost their insurance, they'd still have someplace to go. Someplace free, where even the wealthy could go. No questions asked, as long as they were willing to take a number and sit on a bench. A safety net for the safety net. And the second truth I learned at Laguna Honda is how efficient, how cost-effective it is when doctors simply have enough time to spend with their patients, and patients have enough time to heal. Healthcare economists have based their current ideas on a mistaken notion that doctors are so expensive that anything that decreases the amount of time doctors spend with patients is a good thing, a cheaper thing. But what we've learned over the last 20 years is that it isn't efficient or cost-effective when doctors don't have the time to do a good job. What's a good job? A good job is getting the right diagnosis and the right treatment. And to do that, a doctor needs to have enough time to examine a patient thoroughly, to re-examine a patient, to look at the x-rays, to know the labs, to talk to the family, to try things, to talk to the doctors who've seen the patient, to go back and re-examine the patient and try other things sometimes. I had that kind of time at Laguna Honda, and there were many instances when it led me to question the diagnosis and discover the correct one. And that is cost-effective. So I think we need to give doctors back our time with patients. How to do this? I think we can start by paying attention to some of the experiments that are going on out there. There's the slow medicine movement, for instance, with its attention to the old-fashioned remedy of tincture of time. There's the narrative medicine movement with its emphasis on the personal and the particular. There's the so-called, and I hate this name, concierge medicine movement that allows doctors to revitalize the doctor-patient relationship. In my biggest flights of fancy, I think we should take whole cloth from what I learned at Laguna Honda and have an experimental clinic or an experimental ward. Sometimes I call it the eco-medicine project, where we privilege time, veriditas, and the patient's own natural healing power. We could keep track of how much we spent on those luxuries and how much we saved by having enough time to do a good job, and whether in the end slow medicine is in fact efficient in an efficient sort of way. So this is where I think I'll stop and open up the discussion for comments and questions.
You are listening to the Club of California. And Dr. Victoria Sweet talking about Laguna Honda Hospital and her book, God's Hotel. We're at that point in our program when we invite you in the audience to ask questions and let us know who would like to do that first. I'll start back here and walk back here. I'll walk back to you.
So I had the great good fortune of being a nurse at Laguna Honda in 2007. And so I want to thank you, Dr. Sweet, for your beautifully remembered and beautifully written book. Everyone that I know that's read it, it's a page turner.
Thank you so much. I'll pay you later.
Aha! And what was so special for me, having been a nurse at Laguna Honda, was your book brought the memory back of the joy and the enthusiasm and the inspiration I felt every day when I walked in to the hospital, talked with the residents, my coworkers, and walked down that long corridor and worked on the Florence Nightingale Ward. The old hospital was such a special, special place. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That is a wonderful comment. Really appreciate that very much.
And our second question.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. I work in the hospice field, and I know Laguna Honda has a very large hospice. And I was wondering if you could comment on the movement of hospice at Laguna Honda and how's it going?
Oh, well, that's a really interesting question. We were actually one of the first who had a hospice program there, and it started actually in 1987 by Dr. Curtis of the Shoes. He was a really adventurous and interesting man, and he'd traveled across Europe, and he'd learned about the hospice movement, and he came back, And he was working at Laguna Honda, and he suggested that we start with a hospice ward. And it was a very unusual thing. He got it, pulled it all together. He managed to get the nursing administration in with the medical administration, which was a miracle. He got it funded, and he started the hospice ward. And originally, it was mostly for AIDS patients, and it was kind of an AIDS hospice ward. And then they split off, and Dr. Kay in the book, Dr. Took over the hospice unit, and it was really been a beautiful place and very instructive. Sometimes when I'd go down there, so what Dr. Kay did is he took one of the wards and applied a lot of the Edenization principles. So he, because the Nightingale wards, which I don't talk about too much, which I didn't talk about too much here, but they were the individual long wards. And originally, when Nightingale wrote her book on Notes on Hospitals, she talked about the best hospital would be a collection of mini hospitals coming off of a central ward. She wrote her book before there was antibiotics, and there was no way to treat if somebody on one ward got infected, but by having individual wards, you could shut off the ward and essentially quarantine everybody on the ward. So there was also a little mini kitchen on every ward, and its own set of bathrooms, its own egress to the outside, its own solarium for the sun. And so Dr. Kay took one of these wards and turned it into a particular hospice place, got Zen Hospice to buy in and all that. So it was spectacular. And I think the most interesting thing for me was two things. One is I'd go down there and I would look around and go like, wow, why can't we do this for the rest of the hospital? Because one of the disadvantages of the hospital, for instance, was that it was noisy. All right, these big open wards. But, you know, Dr. Kay had all kinds of rules. You couldn't have your, you know, you had to have earphones, and so it was quiet. And the second instructive thing was how often it would happen that a patient who was supposed to die would get transferred to the hospice ward. Dr. Kay would take that patient off all the medications, and that patient would get better. In fact, one of my most memorable cases on the admitting ward was getting a patient, it was a 35-year-old woman who'd come in from the general to get rehab for a broken leg. And she says, oh, I've been here before. I go, really? She says, yeah, I was on the hospice ward. I said, you're kidding. So I call up her chart, and sure enough, at age 32, she'd been admitted to the hospice ward to die of cirrhosis. She got taken off all her medications, and a few months later, she just was better, and her cirrhosis went away, and she lived long enough to get pregnant, have a baby, and break her leg. So that's what I have to say about that.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and Dr. Victoria Sweet talking about Laguna Honda Hospital and her book, God's Hotel. We have another question.
Actually, I have two questions. One, where does the money come from and how do you get it to fund that increasing budget?
Yeah.
And number two, I'm a supporter of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You've scared me now when you said thousands and thousands of regulations in this act. In your opinion, as a medical professional, what would be the best system for our country to see that everyone has medical care without this constant worry? Is there someplace for me to go?
Great question. Thank you for that question. Two questions. Let me answer the second question first. One of the luxuries I've had, having taken a sabbatical that's turning into forever, these last 2 years, is I've had the time to catch up on my reading. So I actually read the act. I read the whole thing. I sent away for it, and I got it in a hard copy, because how are you going to read it online? It's actually 912 single-spaced pages. So every time you read 2,700 pages, either I don't understand where that comes from. So I'm suspicious whenever somebody starts talking about 2,700 pages, because it's not. It's 912 single-spaced pages. And the thing about it is about, I like about half of it a lot. And I dislike quite a bit of it because it's a nightmare of new regulations. What do you do with that? I mean, they don't talk about that, and I can give you many instances of there's things hidden in there that we are not going to like. On the other hand, you know, it's kind of a mess. I mean, it's a terrible thing to – everybody here worries about their health insurance. Everybody here. So I've done a lot of thinking about it, and my first idea – was to just reopen these, you know, just say, let's just open up the county hospital. It couldn't be that difficult. And just at least have some place that everybody knew they could go. And then if it turned out that everybody was showing up at the free county hospital and we kept having to enlarge it, we would end up with a de facto system. right? We just keep putting money into this free county hospital. It was kind of funky and having clinics and all like that. But that was a little bit of a flight of fancy. So the more I've thought about it, I have to say my conclusion is what we should do is we should just expand Medicare, which we hear all over the place how terrible Medicare is. Medicare is fantastic. If you look at it even from an economic point of view, it spends 3% of every dollar on administration. Private health insurance spend 20 cents at least of every dollar goes to Wall Street. So they're only spending 80 cents in your health care, and Medicare spending 97 cents. So I think the way to do it really is to just expand Medicare somewhat slowly, lower the age bracket at which people can get it, raise the bracket at which they can get it, just gradually expand it, let it ingest, and, you know, everybody can keep their private insurance. But if you need it, you can buy into Medicare. See, I think what we should do is, the way I figured, it's cost $600 or $700 a month if you take Medicare and its budget and divide it by the number of people it serves. So that's about $600, $700 a month. So if people want to buy into it, I mean, it's actually not any more expensive than most people's health insurance these days. Why not let people buy into it? It's a wash for the government. So that's what I have to say about that. And the second question, I'll be quick about it. About 90% of the money comes from the feds. Some of it comes from the state. And then San Francisco ends up kicking in everything else. That's the bottom line. And depending on what's happening, when I first got to Laguna Honda was very proud because using the state and fed money, we ended up with a profit every year. And so that actually, the city actually was making money on it. But over the years, as the regulations have gotten more and the Medicare and Medi-Cal have been cut, the city had to start kicking in money for Laguna Honda. Mm-hmm. Dr. Grace.
I just wanted to say hello to Victoria. I am a first-person witness as a member of her book. I'm a physician that worked with Victoria at Laguna Honda. And I left there to go to UCSF and get my infectious disease fellowship finished. And now working for San Mateo Medical Center, which was one of the few and outstanding county hospitals in the state of California, where we provide pretty much a Medicare system for the poor and uninsured. Our doors are open always to everyone, whether or not you can pay. And we provide an incredible level of care in San Mateo County down the road. Thanks. So we are really, and there is on the part of our administration, a acknowledgement of the importance of time.
Great.
And
great.
Unlike other systems, which, and I don't want to name them or put them down, but where, you know, you mentioned this issue of time with patients, and it is huge. And we try to be efficient. I'm not denying that. And we have had our own efforts to modernize and make more, and make visits more efficient and faster. However, our patients are unique. They're like the Laguna Honda patients. Mm-hmm. They're in general those who are of the greatest need, and we are allowed to spend time with them. I would like to make a point about the Affordable Care Act, which I too have not read in its entirety, but read parts of. The regulations are not being created by Obamacare. The regulations exist. Regulations of hospitals are unbelievable. Mm-hmm. We have state and we have federal regulations, which are enormous and burdensome, time-consuming. Mm-hmm. Are they necessary? Yes, some are very necessary. We need to have an overview of you know, quality of health, and it needs to be looked at. But in my point, from my view, it's in the regulations, which are not created by Affordable Care. Honestly, they exist. I'm part of the infection control, and we have to deal with these things on an everyday basis. So it's one area that we, as a society, should look at and say, you know, what is the system? I think we need an outside view looking in on the regulation process and trying to get it into, rein it in.
I actually heard from a consulting group in England who read the book, and it turns out they're a healthcare consulting group, And they loved it because apparently they have this idea that the problem is has been all the top-down regulation, not just of healthcare, but of everything. But they've specialized in healthcare, and they've just gotten a contract from the Britain National Health Service to do a place. It was really interesting. They're taking a piece of the health service in a particular spot, and they're doing an experiment. An experiment consists of no regulations. That the regulations is going to, because in a way you have to do that, right, is start from scratch because you can't get rid of these regulations. I mean, I have also, and so I think that's really interesting that they recognize it, they got a contract to do it, and how interesting that's going to be. My own contribution is my concept of the law of conservation of forms. I believe that what we need is that every time a new form comes out, we have to get rid of two forms. Until we get down to a feasible level, and then we can trade one for one. But I'm hoping that Congress will pass my law of the conservation of forms. But you're right, Dr. Hasid. Thank you very much. I look forward to visiting CHO under your tutelage, because one of the great things for me in getting to talk to people all over the country is I find out places that do this well or do that well, and I think that's what's going on. There are experiments going on all over the place that we should be able to learn from. So,
I think the place sounds really amazing, and I appreciate you describing it in such a positive light. I'm wondering, actually, though, the kinds of patients that kind of place may attract may not be interested in helping themselves. So I'm kind of wondering how you dealt with that personally without being completely frustrated. I mean, for 20-plus years, that seems like a really long time to keep on seeing patients who maybe didn't help themselves or didn't do the best things for themselves and their bodies. And I was just kind of curious how you got...
I'll tell you.
Not being frustrated?
I guess there was two things. I'm of a nature that I actually kind of appreciate people who don't take care of themselves. In this sense, there's a kind of... or at least our patients, and I think it's why we like them so much. They were tough people. You know, they were kind of rasty. And, yeah, they'd keep smoking. They'd be coughing and smoking and coughing through their, you know, trach tube, smoking through their trach tube. And, of course, it would be frustrating as a doc, but there's something about how they maintained their sense of integrity, their sense of who they were and how they wanted to live their life that I respected. They were also really strong people because, you know what, you didn't end up there unless you'd gone through a lot. So we had, like, very good material to work with. You didn't have to do very much. You know, if you could get them, if they would just stop smoking quite so much, they'd get a lot better. So I had low expectations, which were usually met, and sometimes exceeded. And I did just kind of let it go. I mean, I think you can't be too attached to the healing of your patients. And I'll tell you where I'm coming from for that. Years ago, when I was just a little young baby doctor, some patient thanked me for healing her, whatever it was. And I was like, oh, that was cool. And I kind of walked out and I thought, well, wait a second, though. If she disheals, if she unheals, if she gets sick again, like, is it my fault? And I didn't want to take that on, you know? It's like I felt like I do what I can, I let it go, do the best I can, and then I have to let it go because you cannot be attached to that, you know? It just doesn't, it's not good for you. In case you're in the healthcare field and worried about that. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. My daughter, actually, who's now in her 30s, used to tap dance every Christmas at Laguna Honda in that auditorium. And actually, who was it? Bing Crosby or somebody used to do the Christmas shows from Laguna Honda. I mean, it is a fantastic place. I'm just curious, one of the trends in medicine now is to go to computerized forms or these systems like Epic, and I was curious on your take of that because it seems to me it would limit the questions one would even think to ask because then the forms run the conversation, and I was just curious about your take on that.
Nothing to add to that. You're very eloquent. I think it is very scary what's going on. The Electronic Health Record Act. I didn't even know that. I thought it was part of the Obamacare, but when I read it, it's actually in the 2009, like, Support America Act or something. It's this huge law that all doctors are going to have to have electronic systems. Now, without, you know, I am a proud Luddite, okay? I wrote this book with a fountain pen. And I will sign your books with a fountain pen. But I do use a computer, and I do think there is a way to have an electronic health record system that does all the things it should do. And I'm one of the things I want to look at in the next several months at CHOP and Kaiser is see what systems they use. But right now my understanding is what we do know about electronic health records is a few facts other than all the hype. They take about a third longer. The doctors are spending a third of their time, so they're seeing a third fewer patients when they get an electronic health record system. They're supposed to be able to talk to each other. I mean, one of the big cost savings is that if you don't have to order three MRIs on the same patient, right? So they don't talk to each other. So there's basic problems with the way electronic health records are being implemented. We can all imagine a kind of Facebook-y health records. That's how I think of it. You know, something that was great. The patients are just on some sort of, you know, HIPAA, and everybody had the same system. And you could go on, and there's their patient's face, and there's all the doctors who are writing notes in the consults in that scrolling kind of thing, and on the sides were little labs you could click on. You could see all the labs from all over the place. But we don't have that. So part of it is a lot of it is the implementation, but the implementation is pretty scary. That's my opinion. But I haven't had to, I mean, I used some of it at Laguna Honda, but it wasn't bad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because for me, my biggest problem is I see notes and there's not enough detail, and consequently, it's hard to tell who the patient is. If you just say a 40-year-old, you know, white woman, and then you go into the medical history, whereas before we would say housewife with, you know, who fell chasing a child, that's the problem is personalizing them, I think. Greatest problem. Okay.
Thanks, Dr. Hussein.
As a former social worker at San Francisco General, this is a very wonderful topic to hear from you and have a chance to listen to this discussion. I was just curious to find out from you if you're a sort of the philosophy that you bring to this work and have brought has rubbed off on any of your colleagues at Laguna, and then moreover, do you feel that this is something that you're sort of being called to pass on, if you will, and maybe the book tour and the travel that you're doing may really lead you into actually, if I can say it that way, taking it on the road, you know, and this philosophy that you've developed, and whether it's something that you feel maybe called to continue to share around the country?
Well, thank you very much. I wouldn't say that my philosophy rubbed off on other people. Their philosophies rubbed off on me. I mean, really, part of what the book is about is, I didn't expect anything, and it took me a long time, years, to kind of go like, whoa, this place is really interesting, and I learned not just from other doctors, but I learned from the patients, but I learned from the social workers, and I learned from the nurses and the certified nursing assistants and Rose, the janitor. I mean, people, it was that kind of place. So, and I think that's why I do feel, I don't know, called, but certainly impelled to kind of get it out there. First of all, because I'm getting tremendous, this is what you've heard, this is what I'm getting all the time, emails and letters from people who contact me, and they have this experience. There's the people who've had the experience, and then there's the younger generation who wants this experience and who, don't tolerate cant and hypocrisy very easily, and they know that the essence of the matter is the contact with the patients and the personal relationships. So it's really very exciting, and I don't know where it's going to lead, but I think it is going to lead someplace. I think that the pendulum is already beginning to swing, and I think one of the reasons this book has kind of taken off is because it's catching that pendulum on the way back of going like, you know what, this is all good. Let's use what we can use computers for and this stuff for, but it's not for everything. And now we need to start being clever. I mean, this computer stuff has been going on for 25 years, so now it's time to go, what is it good at and what it's not good at? It's not good at everything. So
thank you very much. I will ask you two questions, but you're welcome to answer either one. You will choose. One of the things that I took from your talk is you're thinking about efficiency and hidden inefficiencies with inefficiency, and efficiency being or data is on efficiency being produced by the health insurance company, but not necessarily visible to us as consumers, as ill people. So that's one thing that I'm curious about. Where do we get access to efficiency information as consumers, as patients? And the second is listening to you, one is inspired to advocate for oneself and for a change of the mm-hmm. system. Mm-hmm. And if you do have any suggestion to us in ways that we can practically advocate for ourselves and for a change in the system.
Wow. Those are both really interesting questions. Thank you. And they're hard questions. You know, your second question I need to actually really think about. You know, for a while I answered it by, I don't know if it was sort of flip of just expecting, because you can't, the docs now are on this computer, right? And this computer is just controlling their lives. They have to get from one screen to another, and they've got 7 minutes to do it, and everything's on it. They're just staring at the computer all the time. So for you to say, you know, hello, come and turn around, look at me, I don't think it's going to work. So I don't really know, and I think I should know, so I'll tuck that away. In terms of the efficiency that the insurance companies are doing, I'd say two things about that. One is, here's what I know about their efficiency. And when they talk about efficiency, they mean saving money. That's what they mean. Is it in Obamacare, it's a law in Obamacare that insurance companies have to spend 80 cents of every dollar they get. So I conclude from that they're spending considerably less than 80 cents, more like 72 cents. So if we had a nonprofit system, I mean, what Switzerland does, just to give you an example really quick, is the Swiss system is a really interesting system, because what they do is they provide, so back to, you know, do we have almshouses, do we have Medicare? The Swiss system is everybody's required to have basic health insurance. That's where Obama got that piece from. But the fundamental difference is in the Swiss, that private insurance companies have to sell that basic health insurance on a nonprofit basis, which would decrease everything by 30%. On top of that, then they can sell kind of their silver one and their gold one. So everybody has to have a basic, and then on top of that, you can buy if you want a private room or other, you want your own consultant. And that's how they do it in Switzerland. And one of the things that isn't in the Health Care Act, and it wasn't because Obama didn't try, there's two things that just makes you crazy. One is that, how can you just hand this plum to the insurance companies? Because who mostly doesn't have insurance? Healthy people. So you're now going to make healthy people buy insurance from for-profit companies. This is like this riches coming into them. I mean, why not have that, what they did in Switzerland? It's got to be on a nonprofit basis. That's the first thing. And the second thing is the pharmas are also not nailed in there. Because in Switzerland, again, in most other countries, you know, there's some kind of limit to how much they'll let insurance, the pharmas charge. And I'll give you one little example that just made me crazy. How are we doing on time, Anne?
We're getting close to the end.
Okay, well, this is a story about pharmas. And this was about 6 years ago. I had a patient. Pharmaceutical companies. So Roche and all those guys. And I'm glad they're inventing new drugs, okay? They're entitled to their profits up to a point. But let me give you one example that just made me crazy. So this was a patient of mine who was 50. He was a house painter. He had a little son. And he suddenly got Hodgkin's lymphoma. I think it was Hodgkin's. And at the time, they had just discovered that the old drug from the 50s used for sleep, thalidomide, was fantastic, because the same problems it caused when women were pregnant to the fetus, which was disrupting all the mitotic bands or whatever, you know, was also worked great for lymphoma. So this young man, well, he wasn't that young, this guy, we had to get him thalidomide. We had to get special dispensation because the thalidomide, and this was a drug invented in 1958, actually before then, the city was being charged $10,000 a month to give him thalidomide. And in Mexico, you could get thalidomide for 50 cents a month. Now, this is just outrageous, and Obama couldn't get it. That was part of the compromise. I'm sure he wanted to, right, have some kind of limit, but I can tell you as a physician, I see these case reports of, you know, some new drug that's going to cost $150,000 a year. And it gives you, there's not even all that much, maybe a little bit. We can't do that. And every other country limits that, and this new act doesn't, because I'm sure he had to make a compromise with everybody.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and Dr. Victoria Sweet talking about Laguna Honda Hospital and her book, God's Hotel. Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program for our last question and final comments.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Sweet, for this. I've never heard you speak before, and it's a breath of fresh air. I'm a former social worker and also a life performance coach. I was in Alameda County. And anyway, what I wanted to ask you is, given that you worked in this wonderful environment at Laguna Honda, and you've had this, and now I know you're on sabbatical, What are your thoughts? Do you even know yet if you will go back to being a, quote, you know, doctor, will you hang up your own shingle? Do you know at this point what you want to be doing, or do you want to create something new?
I don't know. I mean, I'm getting a lot of attention, and I'm teaching. I do teach the medical students how to examine patients at UCSF, so I'm doing some teaching. I don't know. I'm waiting to see what happens. I'm in a fortunate position because the book was very popular in New York, and I got a very nice advance, so I don't really have to. So I'm just waiting to see what arises. I expect something really interesting will arise, and I'm going to wait for that. I'm determined not. I just can't. My temperament is not. I can't let a computer tell me what to do. It makes me crazy. Okay, so.
Our thanks to Dr. Sweet and all the people who made Laguna Honda such a special and visionary place. Our thanks also to our member-led forum in health and medicine and William Grant, who made this particular program possible. I'm Ann Clark, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is officially adjourned.